Tuesday, January 15th, 2006, at 1:41 p.m. We are in State Capitol Building, room 468 here in Pierre. My name is Bob Starr. I'm the chairman of the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission, and joining me here in Pierre is Dusty Johnson. And I should note that Commissioner Hansen has been ill, and we're just waiting to see if he would call in, so we'll be mindful to listen in and see if he's able to make it. But I know he is feeling very much under the weather. To start off, I wanted to make a couple introductions, some new staffers that we have on board. Jason Schuhart is our new consumer affairs specialist. Welcome, Jason. And also not here, but a new face in our office is Barb Templeton, who is a part-time secretary and is providing some assistance in the office here in Pierre. And then, of course, we have our new executive director, Patty Van Gerpen. Congratulations. Sitting next to our former executive director, Pam Bondard. You know, Pierre's a small town. And we welcome Pam back as well. We will start the commission meeting with administration. And first item is the approval of the minutes of the commission meetings held on December 6th and December 20th, 2005.
Mr. Chairman, I would move approval of the minutes.
And I will second. Next is consumer report, status report on consumer utility inquiries and complaints received by the commission. Ms. Gregg.
Thank you. The commission has received a total of 178 contacts since the last report was prepared for the December 20th, 2005 commission meeting. 44 of the contacts involved telecommunications, 25 involved electrical services, 45 involved natural gas, 3 contacts involved gas and electric services, 12 contacts involved cellular phone service, and 22 contacts related to the Do Not Call registry. And 28 contacts were related to issues not regulated by the PUC. 52 of the complaints received thus far in 2006 have been resolved, and there were 1,882 consumer contacts during 2005, and 1,641 of those complaints have been resolved.
Thank you very much. Next is consumer complaints, CT05001, and we're going to move that to the bottom of the agenda. Following that is electricity, EL05018, in the matter of the request by Octel Power Company for approval of an affiliated wind power purchase agreement and of change in the fuel adjustment clause calculation. And the question today is, shall the commission dismiss the docket without prejudice? And do we have anyone appearing on behalf of Octel, or is staff going to take this? Mr. Jacobson.
Thank you, Chairman. The company, by letter dated December 14th, has requested to withdraw this docket and without prejudice, and staff would just acknowledge it and go along with it.
Thanks. And what's happening in the docket?
Well, actually, according to their letter, because time has gone by, because the issue in Minnesota has dragged on longer than they expected, and costs for the project have increased, they have just requested to withdraw the petition at this time.
Thank you. Any questions? I would move that we dismiss the docket without prejudice.
Second.
Next, number two, EL05027, in the matter of the filing by Northwestern Corporation doing business as Northwestern Energy for approval of tariff revisions. And the question is today, shall the commission approve the tariff revisions? Mr. Jacobson.
Thank you, Chairman. The company and staff have requested this matter be deferred until at least the next meeting.
Thank you. I will move deferral then.
Second.
Next, under telecommunications, number one is TC05096, in the matter of the establishment of switch access rates for the Local Exchange Carriers Association. And today, the questions are, pursuant to 4931.12.4, shall the commission suspend the operation of the tariff for an additional 120 days, which I have been told should read 160 days, beyond the proposed effective date of the tariff? Excuse me, did it say 160? Excuse me, make that 60 days. Beyond the proposed effective date of the tariff. Ms. Kramer?
Thank you, Chairman. The statute, as you noted, does allow for an additional 60 days, and staff is requesting that that be permitted. And I did let the parties all know that the agenda was wrong and it should read 60 days, and I did not hear from anyone.
Thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chairman, if it's appropriate at this time, I would move that the Commission suspend the operation of the tariff for an additional 60 days beyond the proposed effective date of the tariff.
And I will second. Next, under telecommunications number 2, in the matter of the approval of addendums to agreements and dockets, or excuse me, amendments, easy for me to say, to agreements and dockets TC05195, TC05196, and TC05220. And the question today is, shall the Commission approve the amendments to the agreements? Ms. Griff? And we will see, Kling Siebel, do you have anything on behalf of Quest?
No, we have no comments, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Ms. Graff?
Thank you, Chairman Sauer. All the companies that have applied or that have submitted these amendments do have proper COAs with the Commission. The amendments were properly filed and executed. They contain no discriminatory language, and no comments were filed during the 20-day time period. Staff would recommend approval of all the amendments.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none, I will move that we approve the amendments to the agreements.
Second.
Next item, number 3, under telecommunications, is TC04213 in the amount of filing by Brookings Municipal Utilities doing business at SWIFT Telecommunications for designation as an eligible telecommunications carrier. And the question today is, shall the Commission designate Brookings Municipal Utilities doing business at SWIFT Telecommunications as an eligible telecommunications carrier? Are we taking any comments from the parties today, or are we just taking action?
No, I believe the Commission is just taking action.
Okay, thank you. I have a rather lengthy motion to read, and I apologize for that. And if anyone needs a copy of that, please let us know, as opposed to trying to keep up with this. Motion for TC04213. I move that the Commission find that Brookings Municipal Utilities doing business at SWIFT Telecommunications has met the requirements to be designated as an ETC, and that it is in the public interest to designate SWIFTEL in the following areas. For the non-rural areas currently served by Quest, I move that SWIFTEL be designated as an ETC for the wire centers listed on its most recently submitted Exhibit B. For the rural areas, I move that the Commission find it is in the public interest to grant SWIFTEL ETC status for the rural areas where SWIFTEL has committed to serving the rural telephone companies in entire service areas. I move that SWIFTEL be designated in the service areas of the rural LECs listed on its most recently submitted Exhibit C. For the rural areas where SWIFTEL will not serve the entire study areas, I move that the Commission redefine the service areas of the rural LECs listed on its most recently submitted Exhibit D. These redefinitions are contingent upon the FCC's concurrence in the redefinitions. If the FCC concurs in the redefinitions, then SWIFTEL will be designated as an ETC for those areas. I further move that the Commission impose the following conditions. 1. On or before February 1, 2006, SWIFTEL shall file its advertising plans and materials for South Dakota that it plans to use to inform consumers of its universal service offerings. Included in these advertising plans and materials shall be the advertising plans and materials regarding the Lifeline and LinkUp programs and the forms for applying for Lifeline and LinkUp in South Dakota. 2. On or before February 1, 2006, SWIFTEL shall file its service agreements pursuant to which it intends to offer its universal service offerings in South Dakota. The agreements shall be consistent with the Commission's service quality rules and shall also advise customers that they may qualify for financial assistance under the federal LinkUp and Lifeline programs and provide basic information on how to apply. 3. The service agreement shall state that any disputes or claims arising under the service agreement may be subject to the Commission's complaint jurisdiction at the consumer's option. Thus, SWIFTEL's service agreements shall not compel submission of disputes to arbitration, which would deprive customers of access to the complaint procedures of SDCL Chapter 49-13 and ARSD Chapter 2010-01. 4. Consistent with its obligations pursuant to Section 214E1, SWIFTEL shall continue to build out facilities and extend service to meet the statutory objective of offering service, quote, throughout the service area for which the designation is received, unquote. 5. In conjunction with, but separate from, in addition to its annual certification filings under 47 CFR, sections 54.313 and 54.314, Swiftel shall submit records and documentation on an annual basis detailing its progress towards meeting the statutory objective of offering service throughout the service areas for which the designation is received. At a minimum, such information shall detail the location and cost of material capital expenditures made by Swiftel within the state of South Dakota during the preceding annual period and shall include its proposed capital budgets for the state of South Dakota for the ensuing year. Swiftel shall work with commission staff to determine what constitutes material expenditures. If Swiftel and staff are unable to agree, either party shall bring the issue before the commission for a decision. Six, Swiftel shall annually submit proposed plans for the upcoming calendar year, which set forth Swiftel's proposed plans for the construction of new facilities and service enhancements to existing facilities. The plans shall be submitted on or before March 1st of each year. Following the first filing, Swiftel's subsequent annual filing shall also include a report stating whether or not the proposed plans were implemented, any deviations from the previous year's proposed plans, and the reasons for any deviations. Following this annual filing, Swiftel shall meet with commission staff to discuss the proposed plans and any deviations from a previous year's proposed plans. 7. Swiftel shall commit to and abide by the terms of the Cellular Telecommunications Industry Association Consumer Code for Wireless Service as it is amended from time to time. 8. By March 1st of each year, Swiftel shall provide annual reports detailing the consumer complaints it has received during the previous one-year period. This report shall include the nature and location of the complaints. 9. By March 31st of each year, Swiftel shall provide a report itemizing the number of unfulfilled requests Swiftel has received to provide service to current customers' residents during the previous years and requests for service from potential customers within Swiftel's service areas that went unfulfilled during the previous year, including the steps Swiftel took to provide service and the reasons why such requests went unfulfilled. Following the submission of this report, Swiftel shall meet with commission staff to discuss the report. 10. In the event that commission staff believes information beyond what Swiftel has provided is necessary for staff and the commission to perform the responsibilities relating to Swiftel's meeting's obligations under the law in this order, staff shall first make a request for such information to Swiftel. If Swiftel objects to such requests, staff and Swiftel shall first confer in an effort to resolve the issue. If, after such conference, staff and Swiftel are unable to reach agreement concerning the need for such information or the reasonableness of such requests, staff may petition the commission for an order modifying the conditions herein upon a showing of good cause, therefore. I would further note that by this motion, I am not recommending that the commission approve Swiftel's proposed 5-year build-out plan as submitted in this proceeding. The 5-year plan appears to be more of a plan on how it might spend anticipated USF funds as opposed to a plan on how Swiftel intends to provide service throughout the service areas. For example, it is doubtful that Swiftel can meet the standard of providing service throughout the service area for which designation is received by putting up a few repeaters in the next 5 years. Thus, each year, the Commission should closely review Swiftel's records of expenditure and where those expenditures are incurring in order to determine whether Swiftel is complying with the statutory requirement. As the Commission stated in its RCC decision, if a competitive ETC is unable or unwilling to provide service throughout its service areas within a reasonable time frame, the Commission will revoke that carrier's ETC status.
Mr. Chairman, I would second the motion, just noting again that eligible telecommunication carriers do have an obligation to serve throughout the service territory, and a reasonable person might look at the proposed 5-year build-out plan and see that as coming up a little short with only one new coverage tower in 5 years.
Thank you. Next, we will go to back to consumer complaints and CT-05001 in a matter of the complaint filed by WWC License LLC against Golden West Telecommunications Cooperative, Inc., Vivian Telephone Company, Sioux Valley Telephone Company, Armor Independent Telephone Company, Bridgewater Canastota Independent Telephone Company, and Kadoka Telephone Company regarding intercarrier billings. And the questions today are, shall the commission grant the motion for partial summary judgment, and shall the commission grant the motion in limine, and shall the commission grant the motion to compel production of discovery responses? And I should note, hopefully it won't be an issue, but we do have our appropriations hearing at 4 o'clock, and if we do run into a time crunch, we would have to adjourn and then come back afterwards. So just everyone can make note of that, and hopefully that is not going to be the case. But just in case, you are forewarned. With that, Mr. Wieczorek?
I will keep my comments to the allotted 40 minutes.
Well, you did the math too fast.
If it meets with the Commission's approval, since we made the motion for summary judgment, I'll deal with that. I'll reserve my comments concerning the motion limit as a response to the argument that would be made by respondents and intervener. Just for the Commission's information, the motion to compel has been resolved. We received some additional spreadsheets last Thursday, I believe, and then we reached an agreement that there's going to be some supplemental spreadsheets distributed, that any supplemental spreadsheets distributed will be distributed either unprotected or with the password, so people can look at them, analyze them, and go into the documentation. And I believe that correctly states the conclusion on that. Then I begin with the motion for summary judgment. I am not going to repeat everything that contained in the brief. I might cover some of it a little bit, but I'm going to try to keep my responses mostly to replying to the brief that was submitted in opposition. I think the first thing that the Commission needs to understand is what procedural capacity this Commission currently sits on these claims. In the reply brief, there was citations and discussion and argument regarding 47 U.S.C. Section 252, citing to an arbitration decision that this Commission decided back in 96. I think it's important that the Commission understand that that is not the capacity that you're sitting in today. Alltel WWC does not contest in an arbitration pursuant to 47 U.S.C. 252B that this Commission can actually determine terms of a relationship between telecommunication carriers. However, what you are faced with today is an agreement, an interconnection agreement, that was a voluntary agreement under the statute 47 U.S.C. 252A that this Commission then approved pursuant to Section E2 of that same statute. Under Section E2 of that statute, you approved it without reservation. There are limited reasons you can deny a voluntary agreement, negotiated agreement. There was no denial. There was no send the parties back to clear up an issue at that point, which is power of the Commission at that point. Given that, you have an existing interconnection agreement, which essentially becomes and has been positioned in this action as essentially a contractual agreement between the parties. This is an action that's been asserted under your complaint procedures, which has dual jurisdiction with the circuit courts. The counterclaim was asserted in the same format. So you are essentially faced and making your standard review just like a court would. And so that is why I think that argument under 47 U.S.C. 252 is inappropriate in this context, because procedurally you are not in that context. Now, where does that put this commission? That commission puts you in a position to enforce the law and make determination of the contractual rights the parties agreed to. So at this point, one of the things that was raised by the opposing brief is that if there is no remedy then if there's a summary judgment where you cannot resolve the agreement-to-agree term. The agreement-to-agree term, it was repeated in both briefs. Essentially, you have language that says that the parties have agreed to a 3%, that they're going to modify that 3% if they can reach a mutually agreed-upon traffic study. Obviously, at this point, we have not been able to reach a mutually agreed-upon traffic study. Now, the question becomes, under the law, whether that's an enforceable agreement to force us or that this commission can essentially step in and determine what should be the mutually agreed-upon traffic study. And in the response brief, respondents and SDTA cite to a lot of other jurisdictions, but frankly, this commission has to come back to what this court has said. And our Supreme Court has looked at this issue in at least two cases that are very direct. And probably the most in-depth review of this situation and agreement to agree was the Deadwood Lodge Albert case, which we cite. In the Deadwood Lodge Albert case, the agreement provided for a rent and that the parties would later consider and determine the rent. And this was the quote from the contract that the Supreme Court was interpreting. Rental consideration which the parties agreed to negotiate a mutually acceptable monthly rent. Here we have the exact same thing. We have a traffic study, which I think common sense reveals is much more in-depth and much harder to figure out with a lot of other factors than figuring out what the commercial reasonable rent is on a piece of property. Now, the opposition has argued that general law has changed somewhat over the last 20 years. However, the South Dakota Supreme Court again in 2002 cited the same basic theory, endorsed the Deadwood Lodge Albert's conclusion that in buying property, if you did not agree to the price, the court is not going to come up with a price for you. So essentially this motion for summary judgment is, look, we have a 3% inter MTA. It is actually the rate that was supposed to be in place at a minimum until the 3 months after the approval of the agreements. Now, we have not been able to come up with a traffic study. There was no action filed actually until a counterclaim was filed in response to this complaint. Mutually agreed upon traffic study has not been able to be resolved because you can have good faith disagreement is what the traffic study should show. That's the second part of the argument. It's because the good faith requirement forces us into negotiations and forces us to agreement, and that's just absolutely not so. You can, in good faith, try to negotiate agreement, but reach a conclusion that you cannot come up with an agreement. For example, if I wanted my friend's vehicle after he is done with it. Let's say every 2 years he buys a new vehicle and gets rid of his old one. I could certainly reach an agreement with him that in good faith we'll set the price when you go to sell that vehicle, but we don't set the price. When that friend goes to sell it, he says, well, here you can buy my vehicle, but I want retail book because that's what a dealer would get. And I said, well, I want wholesale book because that's what a dealer would give you. Clearly, both of those positions are good faith positions, but the term was never agreed upon, or a price, in that case, what would set the price was never agreed upon, and so a court would not step in and force a price on either party. The court would say, under this, agree to agree is unenforceable, and that's why these are unenforceable. In the context of inter-MTA, the argument might be, well, we have a tower right on the line of an MTA. So in the town right next to it that's on one MTA, the RLEC might argue, well, that's an inter-MTA call. And we say, well, it straddles the line, so we don't think that should be considered. That should be thrown out. Those are both reasonable positions. And if you can't come to agreement because that issue on a traffic study, it's because you agreed to agree to a mutually agreed upon traffic study. Your inability in good faith to come to that agreement results in no traffic study. Now, one of the horror stories they plot out in their brief is that, well, then we don't have a remedy. There's nothing there. The interconnection agreement was only valid through last December. They certainly have the ability to cancel an interconnection agreement under the terms of the agreement itself and renegotiate those terms. And if we cannot renegotiate those terms and can't resolve them, we could come to arbitration and complete arbitration with this commission, and the commission could then set that term if we could not come to agreement. Other arguments on the good faith, there's some reference to some cases, but if you look beyond their cases, some of the cases they cite are like UCC cases where, of course, in a UCC case, there's a whole different set of laws that applies. For example, the UCC steps in the law, the state law, substitute terms where you've left terms open. So if you agree to spot price, you don't have an agreement to agree. You have an agreement to spot price on a commodities market. That does not make the agreement agree. The UCC law says that price is filled in because everybody knows what the spot price is. So those cases are totally inapplicable. I can't even talk today. Excuse me. They don't apply in this situation. And in all the jurisdictions that I think this commission has to come back to what South Dakota Supreme Court has said, the language in the interconnection agreement mirrors the language our Supreme Court has said constitutes an agreement to agree. And in that factual scenario that faces the Supreme Court in Deadwood Lodge versus Albert, it was a much easier thing for a court to determine than a court or commission to determine regarding traffic studies. That's all I have for comments.
Thank you. You want to hold questions until we've heard from both parties?
Your pleasure, sir.
If you have a question, why don't you go ahead and ask me?
Mr. Resort, there are a number of different cases cited by you and the other parties, and I'm trying to distinguish between them all, you know, figure out which are most applicable to our situation here. You talk about the UCC cases in the spot market, and I follow that point. In the Deadwood Lodge case, the agreement never dictated a benchmark or a framework or a foundation for determining what that rent was. I use the phrase commercial reasonable rent, but that wasn't contained anywhere in that agreement.
Right.
Does it make a difference in this situation that the foundation or benchmark or method for setting the price essentially was put in the agreement between the parties?
The problem that you, and there might be some overlap, and there actually is when you look at these, but there isn't a price. The 3% is a position that I think is valid at a minimum until 3 months pass. So then you get an argument after 3 months, should this commission essentially set a new inter-MTA rate? And then every 6 months after, should the commission have set a new inter-MTA rate? The problem that you get is not so much the fact that you say there's going to be an inter-MTA rate. The problem you get is when they say that you have to agree to a mutually agreed upon study to come up with that rate. Well, as I gave in my examples, you may not agree and both be in good faith because you just come at the argument in different ways. So I think the fact that you talk about an inter-MTA, and I apologize, I like to use factor as opposed to rate when I talk about MTA because it's really a factor. It's not an actual price rate because there's a whole other issue, and that's the matter of the motion in limine as to whether we talk about different rates that you would use to apply to that inter-MTA. So that is actually one step removed. You'd have to complete the study and agree to a study, complete the study, readjust the rate, or readjust the factor, and then implement the rates. So I'm not sure that answers your question, but I see it as it being unenforceable because of the issue of a mutually agreed upon a study, that you can't reach that this commission cannot decide that for the parties.
Well, Mr. Resort, here's what I'm trying to get at, and please feel free to tell me if you think I'm looking at the wrong, piece of the legal argument here, but, on page 6 of your initial brief, in the paragraph you pulled out, you said, if an essential element is reserved for the future agreement of both parties, the promise can give rise to no legal obligation until such future agreement. I guess I'm trying to determine if an essential element is missing out of the agreement. And I'm trying to determine whether or not, saying this is going to be the method by which you'll determine the factor, whether or not an essential element is missing.
Well, there is no method established. I mean, if we would have come to an agreement and said, this is the cost study we're going to do, but we're not done with it yet, and it's going to take, this is how we're going to do it, these are the steps we're going to go through, this is the data we're going to collect, this is the things we're going to disregard, these are the things we're going to consider, and we just need to complete it, I think you'd have an enforceable agreement, because then you'd know every factor to take into consideration in your cost study. When you just say, we're going to try to get to a mutually agreed upon cost study that might include 60, 70 factors, that's where you do not have an enforceable agreement. To me, the essential difference is, I kind of go back to that, you'll see a lease agreement that might say, we'll enter into a price in the future, which is $100 plus CPI 3 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously that's an enforceable agreement because you tied it to a market. A court come in and say, well, it's just a math procedure. I can enforce that agreement. But going back to the Deadwood Lodge analysis, we just say, well, we'll come up with a price later. The court's like, well, how do you come up with that price? There might be a number of factors that go into consideration there, and there's nothing for me to tie it to. The same thing, I think, comes into the cost study. If you'd say, this is exactly how we're going to do this analysis, this traffic study, you can enforce that. But when you just say, we're going to mutually agree to a traffic study, to come up with this new interim TA rate. It leaves this commission going, should I consider that tower that's on the border? How do I deal with, you know, this, if they can't eliminate the traffic for this IXC carrier, how do I deal with ported numbers? How do I deal with N1 numbers? I mean, all those are all issues that the parties could not agree upon, that the commission is going to have to, if you do what the respondents want, you're going to have to come up with all those issues and say, that's how it should have been done.
Well, I'm trying to get a feel for what the current, you know, framework in this state says, and what is the precedence, what is the case law out there. What would the court say, you know, if you and I had an agreement to sell agricultural property, you know, 4 years from now, based on what the average, you know, per acre price was? Do you have any insight for me as to whether or not that would be an enforceable agreement?
The average, if you said the average of and gave a definition of what you're averaging, I think it would be enforceable. But if you just say the average, does the average include the counties? Does the average include the township? Does the average include the state? Does the average include light real estate? Does the average include all ag designated real estate? Does the average include land on the border of Sioux Falls? That's ag real estate, but obviously it's development real estate at the same time. I would say the court would simply say that's totally unenforceable unless you give a definition of what you mean when you say you're going to take the average of it. You'd have to define what you're averaging.
Okay, thank you. And I apologize for the hypothetical. I'm trying to get, as I said, a better understanding of what the legal framework looks like.
I fully appreciate that. It's as one of my partners says, it's a little esoteric in law occasionally. So,
thank you, sir.
Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Wazarek. Just following up on Commissioner Johnson's question, could I draw your attention to the language itself in Section 7.2.3?
7.23.
And I think we all know the sentence we're talking about. And it would be the last sentence of the second paragraph. And Commissioner Johnson's question, if I remember it correctly, assumed the existence of a method in the agreement. When I look at that sentence, the last sentence of paragraph 2, it states there that the good faith covenant is stated as a covenant to arrive at a method. And does that mean, is that true?
Well, I think if you read that sentence where it says the parties essentially use good faith and one of the other factors that they relied upon in the brief, the Golden West companies, was there's reasonable. I think it gets you right back into the analogy that I gave with the car. I mean, in good faith, I think wholesale as the buyer might be the correct, and it's a reasonable position to take. That's all a dealer's going to give you, and if you try to sell it on the open market, you'd have advertising costs. You might never find anybody to buy it from you. People tend not to like to buy cars, use cars from individuals just through paper. It tends to drive the price down. But if I go to the dealer, his retail price, the other side, the guy selling it, he's totally reasonable in making a good faith determination that he believes that the same price I have to pay to go get it from the dealer should be is the correct price. So I think by throwing good faith and reasonable in here, I mean, the cases, in fact, some of them talk about, the ones we cited in our brief, talk about how good faith actually makes it, what's good faith? I have to enter the mind of the businessman to determine whether he made a reasonable business decision in taking his position on how the traffic study should go. Those don't clear up this matter at all.
And because the clause reads, proceed toward the development of a method of traffic study, right?
That's
the language. So does that presume that there is no method currently stated in the document?
I believe it does, and because it said, if they had a method, you'd see it in this agreement.
I believe this section was 5.4 that Golden West pointed to.
It may have been 5.12 to talk about local traffic or termination of inter MTA traffic. 5.4 talks about measuring traffic. That's correct.
So I'm assuming that reference that Ms. Rogers made in her, or that the Golden West and SDTA made in their filing was to that section as providing a sufficient, quote, method. But I guess my question is, by phrasing the arriving at a method as the actual task, if you will, for the parties in 7.2.3, would it be the position of Western Wireless that neither 5.4 nor any other provision of this agreement in fact provides a method for adjusting the inter-MTA factor?
It does not, for the sole reason that the agreement doesn't contain enough information for you to do a traffic study. There's still a number of presumptions that would have to be made. And those issues, like I said, it's not even a value of a car type of deal where you could say, we're going to do book value at retail. I mean, you can come up with that, or you can. It just doesn't exist in a traffic study that you can have even one factor and say we have an agreed upon traffic factor. Those might lead a base to start with, but actually, as you pointed out, the toward language clearly sends a signal that that's something they still need to work towards to consolidate and come up with in good faith what they reasonably, and they're each in their own business opinion, believe should be it. And like I said, those do not, that language does not guarantee any kind of agreement.
Just one last, this is kind of maybe the horror story question here. If the clause is not enforceable, is it Western Wireless's position then that the 3% is just meant to be a default number that carries forward, or does this render the whole thing unenforceable? And if it does that, then where are we?
First of all, the 3% had been essentially used. The 3% was in place when the agreement passed. And as you know from the original filing here, it was retroactively applied. And that's separate apart from an issue as to what rate was supposed to be applied to that. The 3%, as I read it, is in place because if you don't replace it, you don't replace it.
Thank you.
Commissioner Johnson, did you have another question?
I have a follow-up, but I can wait for you.
Yeah. Please go ahead.
Mr. Wazorek, you talked about how because a number of presumptions have to be made by a court that there's not an enforceable contract. Even if we were talking about something as specific as book value for retail, certainly there are presumptions that would have to be made at that point, too, to determine exactly what that means. Is the car in mint condition? Is it an average? What kind of, serial system does it have? Certainly those presumptions wouldn't render the agreement unenforceable.
Yeah, but the difference here, Commissioner, that I think you'd see in that situation based on the hypothetical I've given is you could go get the mileage off the car. That's easily factually determined. You could... you could check to see if it has the stereo in, so if it's got the add-on for the stereo. If it's got the mag wheels, there's a line to add on. So if you know it's going to be retail at those prices, because if you look at, get into used cars in here, but if you look at the differences, even on the retail versus wholesale price, those are different values every time you go along. But those are something simple. You can say, show me the dealer's list on what was on the vehicle and what's your mileage today. Those are, I think, a court can easily enforce in that situation, or can enforce in that situation. You might have to take some testimony regarding the actual facts of the car. But you never had a meeting. The difference is in the pricing, you've never had a meeting of the minds, and that's why the courts don't enforce it. I always was thinking retail. You were always thinking wholesale. I mean, it would be, the courts would determine it inappropriate for me, if you're the one selling the car, to get it at wholesale, because you never agreed to wholesale, even if we factored all the things. And it would be inappropriate to force me to buy it at retail if I never agreed to retail.
Well, I've hijacked your example somewhat. My apologies. But again, throwing out the wholesale retail, I mean, even presuming the parties that agreed on retail, the condition of the car requires some judgment call. I mean, that's subjective, right? I mean, I think it's in good condition. You think it's an average.
There might be some the need for some testimony as to the car. I mean, and that happens. The difference being is that when we have a medium, mine is going to be retail. We might argue over what actually should be considered, but the wholesale retail is you can't force one price down the other. court can make a determination. If you, it's like the lease case. If we say it's based on CPI plus, but I get a credit if I do a certain fix-up, and you come in as the landlord and say, you know, you didn't do that fix-up to snuff, that might be an issue for the court, but the court's not going to throw out the whole agreement because they can, you can bring in a witness to say, yeah, the carpentry didn't meet what was necessary for standards, so I had to go in and fix it up. Those are minor issues the court can get to, but there you have what they've determined to be, you've done more than agree to agree. It's more of a damages calculations or pricing calculation as opposed to these guys haven't reached an agreement as what even the base for the price should be. We're not going to come up with what the base price should be.
Thank you for your patience, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for allowing me to wallow around in the hypothetical muck.
I have a car for sale, too, as you know.
Thank you very much. Do you have anything else, Mr. Weiserich?
Not at this moment.
Thank you. And then we'll on the second motion, then, because you're the responding party, then we'll take your oral argument at that point in time.
Yes, I've avoided commenting on that. I believe I've been successful, but
thank you. Ms. Rogers. Good afternoon.
Thank you for the opportunity to present argument on the motion for partial summary judgment. My name is Darla Pullman Rogers, and I represent the Golden West Companies in this proceeding. The Golden West Companies resist the WWC's motion for partial summary judgment, and if it's agreeable to the commission and also to counsel for Western Wireless or Altel, I will refer to them as WWC, and we can take notice that this is Altel. I think it's important to just back up and look at a little bit of the history of how we got to the point that we're at here today. This complaint was actually initiated by WWC, and the purpose of the complaint, of their complaint, was to question Golden West's decision to credit past due reciprocal compensation payments on the new agreement that was retroactive until January 1 of 2005. And instead, WWC's position is that that should have just been paid outright in cash. And so they brought the action under a complaint proceeding in front of this commission. Now, that issue, for the most part, has, as far as the actual crediting or payment of those past due accounts, has basically been resolved or paid. There are certainly other issues that WWC points to in their complaint, but that particular portion of it has been resolved. So that leaves the issue of the counterclaim. When WWC brought its complaint against Golden West Companies, we filed a counterclaim against them, and that's the highly contested issue of the inter-MTA factor. WWC is now claiming, weeks before the trial, that 7.2.3 should be found unenforceable as a matter of law because it is an agreement to agree. Golden West disagrees with that assertion for several reasons. First of all, and I would remind you, as I know you are aware, but on a summary judgment motion, the facts must be viewed in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, or in this case, the Golden West Companies. And furthermore, case law establishes that whether a provision is in fact an agreement to agree is a question of fact for the fact finder, so it is not an appropriate action for summary judgment. At that point, the game should be over, but let me go on and comment on a few other reasons why we believe that this motion should not be granted. Golden West bases its assertion on its belief that 7.2.3 is an agreement to agree, and we disagree. We do not believe that section of the interconnection agreement is an agreement to agree, and this is why. We base that on several things. But what the case law says, and we've cited it in our briefs, whether an agreement to agree exists depends upon the party's intentions. and whether or not you, as the governing body or the commission that's going to rule in this case, can discern those intentions from what is actually written within the agreement. And we would submit to you that in this case, yes, you can discern what the parties intended by reading the language in 7.2.3 of the agreement. The intention of the parties clearly was that the 3% was an initial factor, not one that was supposed to last throughout the term of the agreement. The very language says this is the initial factor, and it is to be adjusted throughout the term of the agreement. And that adjustment then is supposed to be based upon a traffic study of the actual traffic that is exchanged between the parties. Now, you don't know necessarily what that traffic is when you enter into these types of an agreement. So therefore, it's very common to have provisions exactly such as this one, 7.2.3, in interconnection agreements, because the goal is to arrive at an MTA factor that is accurately reflecting the actual traffic that is exchanged between the parties. So yes, there are parameters within the language in the agreement, and they are sufficient for this agreement to be enforceable. There is also Section 5.4, as was mentioned by Mr. Smith, that gives some insight on how you measure this traffic. But before I look at that a little more specifically, I'd like to point out that, as I said, it's very common in the telecommunications industry for these types of clauses to exist in interconnection agreements. For example, and these are just interconnection agreements that we pulled off of the Internet. They're on file. They're public record. This happens to be one from CenturyTel of Northwest Arkansas. And what it provides is that reports regarding the percentages of inter-MTA or inter-MTA traffic and the intrastate or interstate jurisdiction of the inter-MTA traffic shall be based on a reasonable traffic study conducted by the CMRS providers and available to the companies, and it will be conducted no less frequently than once each quarter to ensure that the provider, that the CMRS provider is using an accurate intra-MTA percentage. In an agreement between Hills County Telephone Cooperative and Sprint, the parties developed an initial factor for the inter-MTA traffic. And then that inter-MTA traffic factor shall be revised by mutual agreement of the parties. The parties agree to review the percentage on a periodic basis, and if warranted by the actual usage, revise the percentage appropriately. And finally, in Ameritech Michigan interconnection agreement, there too, exactly as in this case, the parties agreed on an initial inter-MTA factor, then either party could submit traffic or studies with regard to that traffic that was to be determined in good faith, and the parties shall use such inter-MTA traffic information to negotiate in good faith a mutually acceptable percentage of carrier to Ameritech traffic delivered by carrier to the Ameritech that is deemed inter-MTA traffic. These are exactly the same types of provisions that now WWC is asking you to throw out as unenforceable. And I would submit to you that it is not the same as setting prices for a lease or setting prices for a contract for deed. This is industry standard. Furthermore, with regard to traffic studies themselves, that is also very common in the industry. But one of the big issues in arriving at a traffic study is the location of the cell tower site. And that is defined for you within the agreement. So you do have sufficient parameters within the agreement to ascertain the intention of the parties with regard to the inter-MTA factor and to enforce that provision. I would also like to comment, if I could, on the authority of the commission. I disagree with Mr. Wieczorek's attempt to limit your authority. One of the other big distinctions between the case that you have here and the provisions that I've read to you is we are in front of the commission. And as a commission, it is certainly your, you have every authority that you need to set inter-MTA factors, to order traffic studies, to determine what the appropriate rates are. That's part of your duty and job as defined statutorily and by other cases. One of the reasons that the courts have been reluctant in some instances to enforce what they call an agreement to agree, like, for example, in the Deadwood case where there aren't any parameters, is they say it's not, just generally, it's not the function of the courts to determine a lease rate. It doesn't matter whether traffic studies are complicated or not. It is within your authority to do that. That's what you do. That's what commissions all across the country do. And so you clearly have the authority to enforce this provision of the contract. I also need to mention briefly the issue of bad faith. In the case, at least one of the cases cited by WWC, there was actually a factual finding that the parties negotiated in good faith. Now, there hasn't been that finding here, and in fact, one of the allegations that Golden West has made is that WWC has not acted in good faith. And that's a factual argument. That's a factual determination. We need to be able to come forward and show that. And so we believe that if you look at the actions of the parties, there is an absence of good faith effort to negotiate, and we believe that we can show that and demonstrate that at a hearing, and we believe that this provision should be left in the agreement, and we should be allowed to show the actions that of WWC have not been exercised in good faith. Just on its face, the parties were involved in a negotiation process to try to arrive at this agreement. And it fell apart. They were headed for arbitration. And then on the eve of the trial the hearing on the arbitration, a settlement was hammered out, and this agreement resulted from that. In the course of reaching this, what ended up being this agreement, Western Wireless agreed to Section 7.2.3 of the agreement. They agreed to it. And now they're turning around and saying, well, no, that agreement is unenforceable as a matter of law, and thus they're trying to duck out of their responsibilities under the agreement. And the reason for that is clear. And, in fact, it came up today in Mr. Wieczorek's comments. The 3%, the initial 3% is a very, very, in our opinion, very, very low inter-MTA factor. They want that 3% to remain. That's the whole reason we're here. I also disagree with Mr. Wieczorek's comments concerning if the parties can't agree, then basically we're stuck with that 3% for the rest of the agreement. I don't think the 3% part is something that they can hold on to and choose to abide by and then throw out the rest of the agreement. 7.2.3 and the 3% of it and the whole negotiations part of it is very intricately crafted, and the 3% is not severable. So, worst case scenario, you find the agreement or 7.2.3 unenforceable, there is no agreement concerning inter-MTA traffic. I would submit that either under another section of the agreement, we can come back to this commission and ask you to set that, or we can bill them what we want, and we'll be back in litigation on the issue at some point anyway. If you follow WWC's argument to its logical conclusion, then what is Golden West's remedy? If the parties cannot agree, which he's claiming they cannot, and incidentally, I believe the parties have agreed on a methodology at this point, if they can't, according to Mr. Wieczorek's argument, we're stuck with a 3%, and that flies right in the face of the clear and manifest intent of the parties that you can discern from Section 7.2.3. So that, for those reasons, we would ask you to deny the motion for summary judgment. We do not believe that it's an agreement to agree. We believe you can ascertain and determine the intentions of the parties, and you can enforce that agreement. We believe you have the authority to do so, and this is an appropriate jurisdiction with which to do so. And we believe that it is an appropriate, it is appropriate for you to deny the motion for partial summary judgment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions from the commissioners at this point? Commissioner Johnson.
I do have one. You mentioned in your comments as well as in your brief the authority of the commission. And you talk about how the commission has the authority to arbitrate and settle disputes arising from interconnection agreements. I presume that authority comes from Section 252. And I always assumed that was a forward-looking power of the commission and not a backward-looking authority. Am I incorrect in that assumption?
I believe that you have the authority to resolve all, I think it's called open issues. But in addition to that authority, there is a provision within this agreement that says that disputes that arise over the terms and conditions of this agreement will be brought back here to this commission. So I believe that that also gives you the authority to resolve this issue.
Yes, that's right. Thanks for jogging my memory. Appreciate it. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Smith.
Thank you. Is there a legal requirement that you have an interconnection agreement at all with Western, with WWC? Is it legally required that you have an interconnection agreement with WWC?
I believe that we are required to have an interconnection agreement under the Federal Act.
If they request one, and then you proceed down the road,
and
trying to negotiate one, and if you can't negotiate it, come here under 252.
Right. Now, if they don't request one, I don't know that we'd have an obligation, but I think once they request one, then we go down that path, yes.
Well, you didn't have an agreement, right, until sometime in 2004 when you signed an agreement that then related back to 2003.
There was also a prior, we had an interconnection
agreement. Did you have an interconnection agreement before that?
With WWC. Prior to that time, that agreement then expired.
Okay.
And so then that started the negotiations on a new agreement.
Section 7, one of the problems here is we look at Section 7.2.3. It explicitly uses the words based upon on a mutually agreed. You know, which does seem to, how can we read that as saying anything other than the parties have to mutually agree to it?
Then I think that's where the second paragraph also, or second sentence also comes into effect, which requires the parties to exercise good faith in arriving at mutually agreeable traffic study.
If there were no interconnection agreement in place, how would this whole thing work in terms of doing this, in terms of your billings for this traffic, or would it not be possible for Western Wireless to terminate calls to you, period, in the absence of an interconnection agreement?
If we did not... I'm not sure I know the answer to that. If there was no interconnection agreement between the parties, the question becomes, would there be any other rules or framework out there by which the parties would operate? I mean, the whole purpose of this agreement is to define the terms and conditions by which traffic is exchanged between the CMRS provider and the local exchange company. So if this weren't in place, I don't know that there would be anything to prevent us from charging our traffic pursuant to our tariffs if we didn't have any definition of what was local and what was inter-MTA.
So if this provision, if 7.2.3 is void, period, because it's then does that default us back to that status of a no agreement state, at least with respect to this particular term?
To enter MTA traffic, yes, and I guess I believe that we could do our own study and probably bill them any amount that we wanted to. There is another section in the agreement that says that if one part is not enforceable, the rest of the agreement goes forward. And also there's another one, I think, that that the parties can come back to the commission and ask for some type of remedy under this agreement, which is probably where we would be.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Smith, I asked the question I was going to ask, but I am really grappling with the phrase based on a mutually agreed to traffic study analysis and trying to figure out how that is not an agreement to agree. And, I mean, you already gave his response to that, but that is really, in that provision, that's the language that's particularly difficult for me to see as anything else other than an agreement to agree. I guess I'll give you one last shot on that one.
The reason that I don't believe that that is an agreement to agree is because, again, we're talking about setting the parameters of arriving at an appropriate inner MTA factor. Okay, in like the examples that I used from the other agreements, this is a very, very common way to arrive at it. It does set the parameters because you don't know at the time you enter into the agreement what that actual traffic is going to be. And so you need to then have some type of a traffic study to determine what that traffic is. I don't want to get bogged down in analogies, but it would be more like if you and I agree that that I'm going to pay X amount per square foot to lease a kitchen, but we don't know in advance how big the kitchen is. Okay? So then we have to agree on how we're going to measure that kitchen in order to determine what the actual price is. I don't believe that's an agreement to agree. There are enough parameters there to determine where we need to end up, which is what is an appropriate inner MTA factor in this case.
The looking at that based on mutually agreed to traffic study analysis, I mean, what, and I appreciate your position where you're coming from. I do think that analogy is, and you're doing it on the fly, so it's a lot easier to kind of pick it apart. Isn't quite apt. What seems to be to me to be lacking is if they aren't able to come to a mutually agreed upon traffic study analysis, then X, Y, and Z. I mean, right now isn't it left pretty wide open, other than there's that good faith provision. But to me, that it's what the agreement seems to be missing is kind of that backstop, which is oftentimes do see in business type agreements, where if something's left open, the parties can discuss that, but then there's normally some type of backstop process where then you fall into some sort of default position. To me, this seems pretty open-ended where, I mean, if you look at that, that's what kind of screams out in my mind is, well, what happens if you guys can't agree other than good faith? And I don't know if that really gets us any further beyond the agreement to agree issue.
What happens if we cannot agree is exactly where we are today. We are here asking you as the commission to establish or set or determine an acceptable traffic methodology, which the agreement authorizes us to do.
Well, that to me, though, means we're basically writing a contract provision for you. I mean, that's not what the agreement says. It doesn't say, to me, it says it's mutually agreed, and if you can't come up with mutual agreement, then I don't know where you're at. I don't think the commission can necessarily insert that in of its own volition.
Just a minute, if I could have a minute.
Certainly.
I'm looking for my brief.
I have it electronically if
I have it. I just have too many other papers.
It's the advantage of having the laptops.
And maybe I didn't end up citing this, but I think it's in section 11, one of the subsequent sections in the agreement is where it discusses bringing disputes before the commission, and that's part of this agreement as well. So I believe the remedy is to come back to you and ask you to adjust the inter-MTA factor appropriately or establish a methodology to do so, and you do have the authority to do that.
Does it talk about that specifically with the inter-MTA, or is it just a kind of catch-all provision?
I believe it's the agreement as a whole. It would be any provision within the agreement.
I think the site is right to Section 11. I do think, though, that the provision based on mutually agreed to traffic study analysis, I do think that, I mean, at least in my mind, you know, seems to be an agreement to agree. Now, I mean, there may be some other language in there that you can point to saying, here's what we think should kick in, but in reading the provision of itself, I mean, Mr. Smith right already, but I mean, the mutually agreed to part, I'm just really grappling with seeing that as anything beyond the agreement to agree.
And, Commissioner, I would point out that while I don't agree necessarily with your conclusion that that's an agreement to agree, at most I think it would be characterized possibly as an agreement to negotiate, and there is a distinction there too. But even if, for purposes of argument, we say it is an agreement to negotiate, which is certainly enforceable, or even if we say it is an agreement to agree, agreements to agree can also be enforceable under these cases, especially in instances like this where you have the ability, the wherewithal, and the authority to resolve this dispute. So even in those cases, you know, and right. Again, I don't agree with you that it is an agreement to agree. Agreements to negotiate, unlike agreements to agree, clearly are enforceable.
Well, help me out on those. And I maybe know off the top of your head, Mr. Ray Zurich was talking about how a number, if not all, of those cases involve UCC. Type cases. Is that based on UCC ones, or is it based on non-UCC as well?
I believe it's also based on non-UCC. I think that also we pointed out in our brief that even Williston on contracts, the language cited by West WWC, has changed since that. The new treatise says, yes, there are instances when agreements to agree and not even agreements to agree are enforceable, but for sure agreements to negotiate are, and the key is whether or not you can ascertain the intention of the parties, and we believe that you can clearly hear in these cases.
Thank you. Mr. Coit.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, commissioners, and staff. I don't have too much here, but I would like to make a few comments. We as SDTA would like to concur in the comments of Ms. Rogers. As an individual, as one of the individuals who participated in the negotiations that led up to the agreement, now I look at this argument surrounding this agree to agree, and in a lot of respects it kind of offends me. We have agreed to a lot of different provisions in this contract, and I find it particularly offensive that they would single out one section that talks about coming up with a traffic study analysis, which I agree with Ms. Rogers, and arriving at traffic studies in this industry is certainly nothing unusual. Reference to traffic studies and agreements is nothing unusual. It happens all of the time. PIU factors and agreements are nothing unusual. But you know, if you look at what they're trying to do here, and Ms. Rogers made reference to this, they want to keep a part of Section 7.2 and they want to throw out the rest. They want to keep the 3%, but they want to throw out the provisions that obligated them to engage in good faith and come up with a traffic study that is supposed to come up with a reasonable measurement of terminated inter-MTA traffic. Again, as someone who participated in the negotiations, the 3% factor was specifically agreed to in part because of the fact that they had agreed to continue on and look towards agreeing to a traffic study that could identify a reasonable measurement of the traffic. So it's all part parcel of the same thing. They're trying to split it, take the provision that's most favorable and kick out the rest. We have a big problem with that. And looking at just, you know, traffic studies in general, I'd say there are probably two big issues when you're dealing with a traffic study and you're looking at wireless traffic. One is, what sort of a sampling period are you going to use? And that's a common issue when you're dealing with any traffic study. Are you going to measure every minute, or are you going to come up with a period of time over which you're going to measure the traffic, and then you're going to utilize that on some sort of going forward basis to, you know, come up with a different percentage or utilize a different percentage? The other big one, and I think that is very clearly addressed in this contract, and Western Wireless doesn't want to admit that this is addressed in the contract because they're arguing about it, and they've been arguing about it ever since they filed this. And that is, what is the point of origination of those wireless calls? And they're claiming that that's really not addressed. We can't really determine where those calls are coming from and all of that. Well, it's addressed in the agreement. It's addressed in 5.4. So really, when you start talking about a traffic study and coming up with a reasonable measurement of traffic, really all you're talking about is looking at actual traffic data, of course. We're not going to look at something that is not reflective or not actual traffic. So we're going to look at actual traffic over a particular period of time, and then we're going to try to determine, based on records, of that traffic, where the calls originated and where they terminated. That's it. That's how you do a traffic study. I'd say the biggest issue here, because we addressed the point of origination as being the cell site, the biggest issue is time frame. That's it. We could never come to any agreement on time frame. You know why? Because we could never get any data. We couldn't get any originating traffic data to ever determine what sort of traffic that we were actually, you know, what sort of traffic was actually being terminated. That's been a fight ever since this thing was signed, and it continues to be a fight. But as far as doing a traffic study, it's nothing mysterious. They're making it sound like it's analogous to picking some value, whether it's a wholesale value or a retail value on a car. I disagree. I don't think that's an appropriate analogy at all. Because what you're looking at is actual traffic data, and you're looking at information surrounding that data. And the two biggest issues, once you have identified the traffic, which we've obviously had problems doing, and the reason we have problems doing is we can't get records. The two biggest issues are point of origination and time frame. And I think, I don't believe for a minute that it's something mysterious. So for them to say that somehow we don't have a meeting of the minds, looking at this language in 7.2.3, I strongly disagree with that. Is it written perfectly? No, it's probably not written perfectly. But I think you have to read the entire section. And I think you have to look at that and say, did the parties come to some agreement for something to happen? Something substantive? I think we did. I think we came to an agreement that something was going to happen. And it's pretty clear what was supposed to happen, but it didn't happen. And that 3% factor, I agree with Ms. Rogers. I mean, from our perspective, that is incredibly low. We wouldn't have agreed to that 3% if we had known that we were going to get absolutely no cooperation in the provisioning of traffic records. So we could never even get to the point of actually looking at a traffic study method, because we never had any records that would even get us to that point. We've got an agreement with Verizon that has 20% factor. It's on file with this commission. 20%. I really do think, and this was Ms. Rogers pointed this out, you know, you as a commission, you have the authority to decide what an appropriate factor is where there is a dispute. I think you've already done that I think there was a site in the response to a Quest case where you established a percentage. I'm not sure if it was an inter-MTA percentage or I think it was a local traffic percentage. But you can establish percentages. You know, the fact that there's language in a contract that for a period of time doesn't nail down that percentage, I don't think means that, well, there's nothing there that you can insert or there's no action that you can take. I guess that's all I have unless you have any questions. One other point is that, you know, there, and this gets to the governing law. It says Section 14.16, for all claims under this agreement that are based upon issues within the jurisdiction of the Commission are governed by state law, the parties agree that the jurisdiction for all such claims shall be with such commission, and remedy for such claims shall be as provided for by such commission.
Thank you. Yes, I do. And I appreciate you giving us kind of the practical approach and, I guess, kind of nailing down the parameters of how we would look at this going forward if we felt that we had jurisdiction to do so. I'm going to read this, you know, this phrase is based on a mutually agreed to traffic study analysis. If that said based on a traffic study analysis, I would have a lot easier time doing what you're proposing. I mean, it does say, though, based on a mutually agreed to traffic study analysis. I mean, you take out mutually agreed to, I think it reads a lot differently, and I think you make some, you know, very sound arguments for how you get there. And it sounds like it's you know, at least under your take on it, it's not that difficult, and it may even be, you know, so to speak, blown out of proportion. The problem is that we have to read it with that language in there, and as far as I know, I don't have, when we interpret contracts, I don't know if we can strike those three words.
Well, what does the obligation to proceed in good faith mean? I guess we obviously have some disagreement even as to what constitutes good faith. I feel like I have a pretty good idea what good faith is. Apparently there's a disagreement as to what good faith is.
Well,
and I think you have to read that sentence you have to read that language looking at the entire section and what the entire section says.
Well,
this is not unusual in contracts. In this industry, this is not unusual. You could go, and Darla mentioned just a couple of them. There are many more that are very similar to this that are in agreements with wireless carriers. So the fact that you've got two words in here, then we're going to just take the entire thing out.
Well, and I
write this whole section then, because we got two words, mutually agreed.
That's what lawyers do, is we look at the actual language of the contracts. I mean, and you may still have an argument that can survive as to good faith. I mean, that I certainly am not disagreeing with your potential to raise that, but I'm just grappling with what to do with those three words, if you will, because I think you take away those three words, and the argument you made on how you go through the analysis, I think probably is pretty sensible, you know, at least from my understanding where you guys are coming from on that.
Well, you strike out the entire section, we're right back with the commission and complaint proceeding, arguing about what they should pay and what they shouldn't pay.
Mr. Smith?
Mr. Quaid, I'm asking you the same question as that I asked Darla with respect to whether it's mandatory that you have an interconnection agreement with everybody out there. I mean, are there situations where you don't have an interconnection agreement, where companies do not have an interconnection agreement?
Where companies
with
are willing...
every company that they terminate traffic for.
Where companies are willing to pay the compensation that is billed, mm-hmm. then it's not necessary to have an interconnection agreement. There are some companies that terminate just small amounts of traffic, and they have basically just accepted the same billings that go to the larger carriers, you know, for like local traffic or for an inter-MTA percentage. They accept the same thing that the LEC is billing a carrier that they might have a contract with.
So if the commission, I mean, it is one way the commission might look at this, is that if this provision fails, right, if this provision fails because we are unable to come up with a way to predict what the parties might have done, right, whether they acted in good faith or not, then, I mean, is it possible that the whole section fails and we're left in the situation we would be in with respect to this matter that we would be in if there were no interconnection agreement at all? Is that where we're at?
I suspect what will happen is then there'll be another complaint and there'll be all kinds of discovery trying to recover traffic data based, upon which some reasonable billings can be made.
I think what I'm getting at is the commission, I mean, I've been involved in cases here where this commission decides who gets what without an interconnection agreement there. And I'm just wondering if that's where we wind up if this clause is totally void. And I'm not assuming that it is. I guess I'm assuming for purpose of the question, but I'm certainly not implying that it is. But it's one conceivable result the commission could get to. Is if the clause is void, it's void.
I also think, though, that I guess my argument is that, if you need to look at the entire contract, and you need to interpret one sentence of the contract looking at all of the other provisions in the contract. And I'd hate to think because you got two words in that one sentence that all of a sudden the rest of it doesn't mean anything. And you've got information in there, you've got provisions in there that identify the point of origination in a call. You've got all kinds of information in that contract that define what local traffic is, what non-local traffic is, what interstate is, what intrastate is, what it's subject to. I don't think all of those provisions can be ignored when you're looking at that particular provision.
Thank you.
I'm going to go to staff next. Let's see if I'm looking for staff. We go to Ms. Weiss. Thank you.
Thank you. This is Relaine Weiss. This is a difficult question, and I think the parties have done a good job of bringing up both sides of the argument. But I think what it comes down to is the language does anticipate that the parties are going to agree in a traffic study, and the fact is that the parties haven't agreed on the traffic study. And then, although other jurisdictions may have a less restrictive view on these types of clauses, based on the South Dakota cases cited by WWC, it does appear to meet at least South Dakota's definition of an agreement to agree. Also, I think that in order to give intent or to go back and try to reconstruct any of these traffic studies as was anticipated by the agreement would be impossible. I mean, I don't think you can go back and get a traffic study that would have been valid back in July 2004, which I think the first time they should have come up with a traffic study. I do agree that we have the authority to set inter-MTA factors, but to set them, that's pursuant to an arbitration. And as the parties have already stated, this is not an arbitration. The arbitration was dismissed, and the parties entered into an interconnection agreement. Now, when the commission is going to look at an interconnection agreement, what they're doing is they're interpreting or they're enforcing an interconnection agreement. And generally, what you do with an interconnection agreement when you're interpreting or enforcing it is that it's pursuant to state contract law. And so it appears that when you apply our state contract law, what you have is an agreement to agree here. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Mr. Smith.
Does staff have a position at all on the issue of whether the whole clause fails or is it staff's position that the 3% stays in effect through the term of this contract? And I guess if the whole clause fails, then what do we do?
I think that's an even harder question, but I think if you look at the case law, I mean, if once you strike a clause, the other parts are not necessarily given the intent. You're not taking the agreement as a whole. So if you strike that part, I think you could go with the 3% factor.
Thank you. Any questions from commissioners? If not, Mr. Reisworth.
I do have a question, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Weiss, does the fact that we've been told that InterMTA, you know, that these traffic studies, that's a pretty typical part of other contracts, does that affect your advice at all, your recommendations?
My problem, and I looked at a lot of cases here, and the part I struggle with is trying to, you know, get around what the South Dakota Supreme Court has said on agreements to agree, and that's my difficulty here. And you know, traffic studies, based on my experience in this case, are not that easy to come up with. And you can have some general standards in there, but there's still a lot of decisions that have to be made with those traffic studies.
Would it be your opinion that a traffic study would have to be completed before entering into an interconnection agreement
to make
it stick?
Yeah, what I think what should have happened is, as Commissioner Starr mentioned, there should have been a backstop here. Once you've had an agreement, you have language that says the parties will agree, and there's nothing that says what happens when the parties don't agree. That was the problem. They should have said yes. They could have had an agreement to agree. I mean, they could have agreed to agree in a traffic study, and in the event they can't agree, this happens.
And the arbitration clause at the end of the agreement with regard to the commission playing that role is not applicable because?
It's not really an arbitration clause, in my opinion. And based on other case law where state commissions have looked at interconnection agreements, what they look at interconnection agreements to are pursuant to our state contract law. And that's what I was looking at it pursuant to.
I heard your explanation. I'm afraid it hasn't quite sunk in yet. And I don't have the agreement in front of me. My apologies. They do mention that where there's an issue of dispute, the commission will weigh in. I mean, essentially act as an arbitrator. They may not use that word.
But I think there's a big difference between acting as an arbitrator in a dispute and deciding and interpreting a contract pursuant to state contract law. And I think that's your role right here.
It just set in. Thank you.
Mr. Weiserock.
I have just a couple brief follow-up comments. And one of the first is, so my silence doesn't be taken as agreement, I do not agree with Ms. Rogers' contention that the overpayment has been resolved. I don't agree at all that that's been resolved. As to the 3%, I said when I was out here, when Mr. Smith asked, I said, I think you stated the 3% is what occurs here. I don't agree with if the whole section would go out, which I don't think is the appropriate remedy. I think you only strike that portion that you can't enforce. I think you fall back to the reciprocal rate. But I'm not asking for them to throw out that whole section. So I think that falls in the reciprocal. The section they cite, I agree with staff. It basically says if we have a contract dispute, you guys have the jurisdiction to decide that dispute, and we've agreed to come back here on the contract dispute. It doesn't overrule 47 U.S.C. 252, where the commission, if they're going to modify terms of an interconnection agreement, has to do it at the time that they have the interconnection agreement initially put in front of them. The as to the contract, our Supreme Court's made clear if a contract is not enforceable as a matter of law in its face, it's a legal question. And I think this is a legal question in front of the commission. As to the other states cited, you know, I don't have a chance to look at those agreements. It wasn't provided with them. But I didn't hear the term, mutually acceptable in those descriptions. And we're talking about South Dakota law here, and those are simply contracts, and we don't even know if their states would enforce those contracts as written. The fact that somebody else wrote it in into a contract doesn't make it enforceable as a matter of law. The as regarding Mr. Coit's comments, I'm a little in a difficult situation with that. Mr. Coit's comments, I think, border on testimony at times. talking about the agreement. But one of the things he says, and this I wrote down verbatim, is he said, well, when we did this, we agreed to continue on and look towards a traffic study. Okay. By his own admission, essentially here, he's saying they never agreed to it. They agreed to continue on and look towards. And he also said agreement, that was something that was going to happen. So to the extent I think there's some blurring lines potentially between testimony, those facts he threw out actually support a finding of agreement to agree. Now, as to this whole good faith argument, good faith argument seems to surround what we want to do for a traffic study. If you don't do it, that's good faith. And that is basically the feeling I walk away from when I hear these arguments. And I think on its face, this portion of the agreement that I've made the motion for summary judgment for is unenforceable as a matter of law. It's unenforceable given what was said here today. It just simply supports that. And that's all I have.
Thank you very much. Next, we will take up the question of whether or not the commission shall grant the motion in limine. And Ms. Rogers, I believe you're the moving party on that one.
Find the right file here. Give me a minute to switch gears. We brought the motion in limine in an attempt to limit the issues in front of the court. Initially, I would like to just make a clarification to the actual motion that we filed in this case. In the first paragraph, we're talking about any prior agreements and negotiations leading up to this agreement, and I just wanted to make it clear that what we're asking this commission to limit the evidence to is negotiations that led to the settlement agreement, and then the settlement agreement itself would be excluded or not allowed to be introduced into evidence, and then negotiations after the settlement agreement that led up to the final agreement. So we were not talking about, you know, any other agreements that may have been negotiated between the parties, but just the settlement agreement in this that was the precedent or procedure to, I guess you'd say, or that was entered into prior to the interconnection agreement.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but just procedurally, isn't the settlement agreement filed as confidential? Is there a problem?
We did originally file it, but
is it still confidential?
I think that would be up to WWC. I mean, it was
because they cited to it in their brief, and it wasn't marked as confidential.
When the parties executed it, I believe it was a confidential agreement. Yes. So I guess I can't waive confidentiality on behalf of everyone else.
I'm just asking what you guys can talk about in an open meeting.
I'm not going to refer to it again.
I'm trying to limit you. I'm just asking.
Right. No, I was just trying to clarify exactly what we were asking for in this case. We believe that under the general rules, that this motion in limine should be granted by the commission. First of all, SDCL 53-8-5 states that once there's an execution of a contract in writing, that supersedes all oral negotiations, prior drafts, or stipulations which preceded the execution of the instrument. And under South Dakota law, of course, the parole evidence rule, it states that it is inadmissible to parole evidence is inadmissible to vary, contradict, or add to a contract that has been reduced to writing, and as long as that contract is clear, definite, and complete. And then in addition to that, the agreement itself states that Section 14.18 of the agreement says that this agreement constitutes the entire agreement of the parties. It supersedes all prior discussions, representations, or oral understandings reached between the parties. So to overcome those general rules of law and the specific language of the agreement, WWC must show ambiguity or that the agreement itself isn't clear. Now, as I understand WWC's claim here, they're claiming that the ambiguity is that the agreement fails to specify the factors to consider in determining which of the two access rates to utilize in determining the NRMTA traffic charges, identification of the party responsible for choosing the applicable rate, or when/if/how the rate could or should change, and the party with the right or responsibility for making such changes. I don't consider any of those to be ambiguities under this agreement. And our response is, we're not making new rules here. If you look at the agreement itself, it characterizes the traffic. We're not changing that in this agreement. If you go to section 1.0 in the definition section, it says that there are two types of traffic that are covered by this agreement. There's local traffic and there's inter-MTA traffic. And then those terms are defined. And within the definition of inter-MTA traffic, which in a world of where we're not talking about CMRS carriers, inter-MTA traffic would be toll traffic. It's non-local. So the inter-MTA traffic is defined within the agreement, and if you read that definition includes the fact that it how you identify the traffic with regard to the cell site. So what is covered then under the agreement is you have wireless calls to a wireline call. All right? So let's just look at a couple of examples of that to make sure that we are all on the same page as to what we're talking about. You first ask the threshold question, does the call cross an MTA? Because that's what defines whether or not it's a toll call in the wireless world. In South Dakota, as you're aware, we have 3 MTAs. Okay? So we have, let's just assume then, for purposes of this case, that Denny Law uses his wireless, Altel wireless phone in Del Rapids, and he makes a call to George Sturandel, wireline call, on his wireline or landline phone in Wall, South Dakota. So that wireless call, and assuming too that it connects to a tower site in Del Rapids, is originated in the Minneapolis MTA, and it terminates in the Denver MTA, which is where Wall is located. So it crosses an MTA. That is an inter-MTA call. It's non-local. So then you go to the next question, and that is it interstate or is it intrastate? Well, in this example, obviously, it's within the state of South Dakota. That means, pursuant to the agreement, that your intrastate access rates would apply. Now, if, in my example, Denny takes his same cell phone to Minneapolis, and now he makes that call back to George Strandell at his office in Wall, South Dakota, that is also an inter-MTA call because it is going from the Minneapolis MTA to the Denver MTA, but in this case, it's also an interstate call because it's going from Minneapolis to South Dakota. So that tells you then, under the terms of this agreement, that interstate access charges apply, and that would be the NECA tariff, of the appropriate NECA tariff of the companies. Now, where is that covered within the agreement? If you look at Section 5.1.1 of the agreement, it tells you that inter-MTA or that telephone companies' access charges apply to termination of inter-MTA traffic. Then if you go to Section 2.1 of the agreement, it says inter-MTA traffic is subject to the telco's interstate and intrastate access charges. So there isn't any question with regard to the ambiguities, or there aren't any ambiguities concerning
what this agreement says with regard to the traffic. It clearly states what's covered under the agreement, what rates apply. Commission can clearly determine that within the four corners of the agreement. And that being the case, there isn't any ambiguity, and we believe that any prior negotiations leading up to this agreement and the confidential exhibit referred to by Ms. Weiss should not be included as evidence at the hearing that concerns interpretation of this agreement.
Thank you very much. Mr. Coit?
I don't have anything to add.
Thank you. Mr. Weisard.
Thank you, Commission. The motion in limine agrees that if there's an ambiguity, you can look at parole evidence. And I'm not exactly sure how she's modified her motion. As I understand it, she is taking the position that anything that existed before the interconnection agreement was signed constitutes parole evidence, if I understand that correctly. We have asserted the settlement agreement is relevant to determine what rate to charge for those calls determined under the inter-MTA factor. Now, Ms. Rogers gave a rendition of a perfect world. Actually, this agreement obviously doesn't propose a perfect world. What she failed to inform the commission is the Golden West companies charge every inter-MTA call under that 3% at their intrastate charges. So that means not only did Denny Law never leave the state and call back to the state, but nobody else left the state and called back to any of their territories under interstate. Why is that? Now, essentially, they took the 3% and just charged intrastate, the highest rate, across the board. They did that because, I'm not sure why they did that. The issue we had when we discovered that was the agreement, as we understood it, was that the inter-MTA 3% rate would be charged at interstate rates. And we've raised that issue. Now they come to you and they say that this agreement is unambiguous. Well, if it's unambiguous, then I don't see where in the agreement there is an agreement by the parties that Golden West can charge intrastate rates for all inter-MTA calls, the 3%. That does not exist in the agreement. That raised the fact that we said, hey, the settlement agreement says interstate for inter-MTA calls. And they argued we can't bring that in. I think that is entirely relevant. It doesn't modify the agreement. It clarifies the agreement. The agreement, nowhere in the agreement does it say what they're going to charge if, you know, frankly, if you don't complete a traffic study. Nowhere in the agreement is there agreement as to what to charge the inter-MTA 3% rate at. So even if you were to deny my motion for summary judgment, the issue still stands out. Then this agreement is ambiguous as how you charge the 3% inter-MTA factored calls. Golden West position, you charge them an intrastate. Our position is they were supposed to be charged at interstate. And that settlement agreement says that specifically, and the actual agreement does not tell you anywhere in it that this is when this 3% should be charged, or this is the ratio under the 3% how these calls should be charged. Nowhere does that say. For no other reason, the settlement agreement is entirely relevant to try to figure out what rate was supposed to be charged against that inter-MTA 3%. The statute cited, it's the parole, what they call the parole evidence rule, cited by Mr. Rogers, 5385. It's acknowledged that ambiguity is an exception to that rule by our Supreme Court in McCollum versus Liddell. That's 307 Northwest 2nd 144 and 307 Northwest 2nd 144. I'm trying to stay in my 40 minutes. So, and it's been acknowledged under South Dakota law that contractual provision is ambiguous. And I'm quoting here, the Supreme Court, after application of pertinent rules of interpretation in the face of the instrument, a genuine uncertainty exists as to which of the two or more meanings is the proper one. Well, Golden Lot says interstate for all inter-MTA calls at 3%. We say interstate. The agreement on its face does not resolve that, and therefore the settlement agreement is relevant for that determination. The other interesting aspect of this motion in limine arises out of the fact that in both their answer and their amended answer, Golden West attaches the settlement agreement and uses it as a basis and a foundation for some of their affirmative defenses. So you have Golden West filing this as a part of their answer and amended answer, the settlement agreement they are now telling you that we cannot refer to in the hearing as support for their affirmative defenses. So, in other words, it's okay for them to rely on it for their affirmative defenses, but if we use it to point out that we've been overcharged, we're not entitled to. The basis of this motion, this motion needs to be denied simply for the fact that this issue is not resolved in the settlement agreement. There is no ratio to be used with that 3% factor, and you do not have an agreement as to what rate you have. Polar opposites on it. And that term is ambiguous, or what rate should have been applied is certainly ambiguous. Also, the fact that Golden West is relying on the exact same document for its affirmative defenses, I think, adds to the fact that this commission can look at it, we can offer testimony as to what the intent of the parties were, and that supports what the intent of the parties was. That's all I have.
Thank you. Any questions from commissioners? Counsel? I think Mr. Smith has one.
I guess I, you know, to me, I look at that section 2.1, that last sentence. I mean, it looks to me on its face to be clear as heck, you know, but, can you explain to me? I mean, I don't get it. It says inter-MTA traffic is subject to telephone companies' interstate or intrastate access charges. And we know what those are. They're tariff charges.
Right. And I understand that. And that's why in the brief it said, you know, you read that, and that seems fairly clear. The problem that you come into is that, okay, you have a 3% inter-MTA factor, but you don't have an agreed-upon ratio to use to charge inter or intrastate.
Isn't that just a question of fact as to whether or not, whether the facts bore out their bills or not? And then we've got the effect, as you know, of the law that is lurking there in the background, Section 111 or whatever it is.
The difficulty arises out of the fact that we don't know what those ratios were. Mm-hmm.
But the traffic is what it is. It's either an interstate call or it's an intrastate call.
Well, arguably, but we don't have that data for that traffic. And that is why our testimony is going to be, the agreement was, you don't have the data for the traffic, and that's why you've got to either pick a ratio or you got to pick a rate. Because, you know, it's this discussion of point of origin on the cell site. Well, CMRS carriers bill differently than landline. They have never tracked, as a general rule, or point of origin of calls because it's a moving point. So in the data they deliver, you cannot tell, the general data they deliver, you cannot tell where the point of origin is. And so when you essentially have an agreement that was a year out, and yet you're retroactively applying it to traffic that's more than a year old, I don't know how you go back and recreate more than a year and a half of traffic to actually come up with what the actual numbers are, because the data was never kept in the first place. And so that's why when you have inter-MTA 3%, I'm calling it WWC too, WWC is understanding that it's going to get charged at interstate rates, because nobody knew what those ratios are, and the data was long gone. So there's...
I mean, it is a fact, though, that's not what the agreement says in black and white.
That's why the agreement becomes ambiguous because there is no way to actually calculate that what rate should have been a charge to those 3% of the calls if you want to try both inter and intrastate. And that's the ambiguity that arises. And that's why the agreement, when you kind of read it, okay, well, you know, it doesn't look ambiguous. But when you go to say, well, how'd you come up with the rate?
Thank you.
Staff.
Thank you. It's Jolene Weiss. Staff disagrees with Western RWWC. And we do not believe that the clause in the settlement agreement can be used to interpret the interconnection agreement. In WWC's brief, they state that the parole evidence is only admissible for limited purposes and cannot be admitted to vary the terms of the contract or to add or detract from the written agreement. Well, if you accept WWC's position, what they're essentially doing is writing out the word intrastate from the interconnection agreement. So that does, in fact, vary the term of the contract. If WWC thought that only interstates were going to be applied, then they should never have agreed to put an intrastate in the interconnection agreement. I think with both of these motions, it comes down to the same principles. The parties have to live with what they agreed to in the interconnection agreement. Thanks.
Thank you. Ms. Rogers, do you want rebuttal or...
I just had a couple of brief comments. Number one, if the commission grants this motion, obviously we are bound by it too, and so that means that if we, you know, use this as a basis for claiming some of our affirmative defenses, we would not be able to use that as well. And with regard to what Golden West has been billing or what WWC is alleging, that's really not the issue here. The issue is there ambiguity in the agreement? We also have a state statute that would govern the actions of what Western Wireless has done with regard to billing of unidentified traffic. That, again, is not really the issue. The issue here is there ambiguity. And I think this section 2.1 of the agreement is very, very clear, and it that's what should control in this case. Inter-MTA traffic is subject to telephone companies' interstate or intrastate access charges. I don't see any ambiguity here, and I believe that Western Wireless should be precluded from bringing in the settlement agreement or prior negotiations. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, I some of the legal standards I'd want to dive into a little bit deeper. Given that, I would move that we take this under advisement at this time.
And I will second that. The last thing on the agenda are announcements. The next regularly scheduled commission meeting will be held January 31st, 2006 at 1:30 p.m. in room 468 at Pier, South Dakota. Commission meetings are scheduled for February 28th and March 14th. A hearing in docket CT05001 will be held February 1-3, 2006 in Conference Room 3, Connect Building Pier. The hearing will begin at 9 a.m. on Wednesday, February 1st, 2006, and I have a feeling we'll probably have an ad hoc before then as well. And finally, the PUC offices will be closed Monday, February 20th, 2006, in observance of President's Day. Thank you.